Well, we are picking up this series. It's been a couple weeks since we've been thinking about this, but we've been in the middle of a series called Kiss the Son. This is our sixth lesson in this series. Obviously, that phrase is pulled from Psalm 2, and we're discussing what it is that God has ordained the duties of government and of civil magistrates to be. I actually forgot to put the thesis at the top, as I usually do. Hopefully by now you can almost say it by heart, because I've been saying it every time. But here it is. It is the duty of all government to acknowledge Christ as Lord, and within the limits of its ordained power, promote the Christian religion. Last time we began to look at whether or not this thesis fits our standards. We are a confessional church, and I'm a confessional pastor. I subscribe to the Westminster Confession of Faith as my as containing an accurate summary of the Bible and its teaching. And so it's an important question for us to think about whether or not this fits with what our forefathers had in mind in the Westminster Confession of Faith. And we looked at this through a couple different angles last time, just by way of review. Last time we spent some time on the very first question of the Shorter Catechism, of course, a famous question, one that all of you know very, very well, and how, in fact, according to the teaching of some, it's entailed even in that question that magistrates, that government is to give glory to God. Remember that question and answer. What is the chief end of man? The chief end of man is to glorify God and enjoy him forever. And we looked at what Hodge, Archibald Alexander Hodge, had to say on that subject. He says, if the glory of God is the chief end of every man, it must be the chief end equally of all nations and communities of men. And it ought to be made the governing purpose of every individual in all his relations and actions, public and official, as well as private and personal. So if man's chief end is to glorify God, it's his chief end in every sphere of life, not just in your home, with your family, but in your business, in the station that you occupy in life, and that would go up to and include even those who hold civil office. We spent a bit more time in our confession, and especially in chapter 23, which is on the civil magistrate. We saw a couple things that I think are worthy of pointing out and reminding us of. First of all, in that first section of the confession, God, the supreme Lord and King of all the world, hath ordained civil magistrates to be under him, over the people, for his own glory. Again, a tie-in to question and answer one. And then in the second part of chapter 23, we keyed in on a number of different statements, but one I'll just remind you of. Chapter 23:2 says that the civil magistrate ought to especially maintain piety, justice, and peace. Piety, justice, and peace stands amongst the duties of a civil magistrate and what he ought to maintain, promote, etc. Today, I want to think about I want to think about section 3 of the confession. So I've actually printed out section 3 of chapter 23 of our confession, because one of the things that you'll notice, one of the things that you perhaps already knew, but will be highlighted in this particular talk, is the fact that we as an OPC, as the OPC, and really as American Presbyterians, so it's not just the OPC, it's also the PCA, also even the mainline Presbyterian Church. I'm not sure what state their confession is in these days. Don't have great confidence, but I think this would be true of them as well, that all of us would hold to a revision, what's called the American Revision, to the Confession of Faith. And it's on this particular issue. And so I want to think about why that is, both historically, theologically, what's going on in the world, that the Americans thought we need to revise chapter 23. And so for the sake of that, I printed it for you. I printed a couple of revisions that they made, actually. One very minor one there in question and answer 109 of the larger catechism. This was a revision they made. I'm not going to read all of question 109, but question 109 is, what are the sins forbidden in the second commandment? And I'll just read the first part. I bolded out what they removed, what the Americans removed. The sins forbidden in the Second Commandment are all devising, counseling, commanding, using, and any wise approving any religious worship not instituted by God Himself. And then it has a semicolon, tolerating a false religion. So, just to make that clear, the original version said that the Second Commandment forbids tolerating a false religion. And, you know, that's a pretty weighty thing to think about. What would it mean to be under a confession that says you and I cannot tolerate false religion? In our own context, that would be quite complicated, wouldn't it? To sort of live that out. So they removed that. They removed that. Tolerating a false religion was taken out. But the lion's share of the edit was done on section 3 of chapter 23. So I've printed there the full text of both sections, both in the original and in the American. And I think it's worth us reading it. So the first part here I've underlined, partly because up to that point there's basic agreement. The civil magistrate may not assume to himself the administration of the word and sacraments or the power of the keys of the kingdom of heaven. This is the original I'm reading. Yet he hath authority, and it is his duty to take order, that unity and peace be preserved in the church, that the truth of God be kept pure and entire, that all blasphemies and heresies be suppressed, all corruptions and abuses in worship and discipline prevented or reformed, and all the ordinances of God duly settled, administered, and observed, for the better effecting whereof he hath power to call synods, to be present at them, and to provide whatsoever is transacted in them, be according to the mind of God. Quite a statement, thinking about the original version. All of the pretty expansive duties that the original assembly gave to the civil magistrate. This becomes an issue for the Americans. They want to change this. They think this is not fit for their context. And so, I'll read the American revision now. Civil magistrates may not assume to themselves the administration of the word and sacraments or the power of the keys of the kingdom of heaven, or in the least interfere in matters of faith. Yet, as nursing fathers, it is the duty of civil magistrates to protect the church of our common Lord without giving the preference to any denomination of Christians above the rest, in such a manner that all ecclesiastical persons, whatever, shall enjoy the full, free, and unquestioned liberty of discharging every part of their sacred functions without violence or danger. And as Jesus Christ hath appointed a regular government and discipline in his church, no law of any commonwealth should interfere with, let, or hinder the due exercise thereof among the voluntary members of any denomination of Christians, according to their own profession and belief. It is the duty of civil magistrates to protect the person and good name of all their people in such an effectual manner as that no person be suffered, either upon pretense of religion or of infidelity, to offer any indignity, violence, abuse, or injury to any other person whatsoever, and to take order that all religious and ecclesiastical assemblies be held without molestation or disturbance. So there you have it. That's quite different, isn't it? What do you notice? I'm curious. What stands out as being major change? Denise?
Well, the first one that stood out to me was the civil magistrate.
Yes.
Himself. And in the American it was the civil magistrates themselves.
Yeah. It's interesting.
So the first one was written for the king.
Yeah, it's written for the king. Yeah. In the American context, we'll get into this a little bit. At this point in time, they have a really high sense of the distinct states that exist. And so a unified Presbyterian church is speaking across the colonies. Kevin?
Oh, sorry, never mind. My question, I guess, was this more like a federal level or like a state level?
You know, it's interesting. I found myself asking this question and not totally getting a satisfied answer in terms of who, what they have in mind here. But I think at the juncture at which this is adopted, this is the National Presbyterian Church, and it's right in the shadow. I mean, it's happening down the street from where the Constitutional Convention is meeting the year before in Philadelphia in 1787. And the federal government in its current form has been established only a year. And so I think that's looming large for the Presbyterians as they're drafting this statement and amendment. Michael?
So this is giving, the original is giving tremendous religious powers to the civil magistrate, even though they say at the very beginning they're not doing so. But the ability and the duty to call a synod, for example, and then to be part of it is extraordinary.
Yeah.
And it also avoids mentioning what that pure denomination would be. Who decides this purity?
Right.
And that's interesting that they should
decide
after all of the trouble they had with Puritans and the Church of England.
It's good to remember that when they describe the duty or the right of a civil magistrate having power to call synods, the Westminster Assembly is described there. They are a called assembly at the behest of the British Parliament. And it's interesting, you know, Chad Van Dyck sort of makes this comment in his commentary on the Confession that he really thinks they should have been able to see, even through their own difficulty of being a synod called by a parliament, that this was not a good doctrine. So they were committed to it, even though it turned out to be quite a bit of trouble for the assembly that the parliament called them, and they were at the behest of parliament, because there were several instances in which the assembly disagreed quite strongly with the magistrate. And and basically they had issues along this exact point. So it's interesting to reflect on that. Stan?
So this part recognized the existence of denominations.
Yeah.
So in that context, the other revision to the Confession removed the language about the Pope being an Antichrist.
Yeah.
So, taken together, do you think that the revisers have in mind that the Catholic Church would be recognized as an expression, a legit expression of the Christian faith?
Yeah, I would say I do believe that would be. So Catholic presence in America was established. Maryland actually was a Catholic holdout, or was recognized, Catholicism was recognized. And so it would have been in play as one of the denominations of Christians that was present in America. I think that would be historically the case.
Well, the fact that the phrase tolerating a religion, I mean, the original Westminster canons were very, very antagonistic for the Catholic Church.
Yeah.
They would call a lot of Catholic practices false.
Yeah, right. We'll get into that, because actually, interestingly, they removed that clause and then they left other ones that seemed to almost be stating the same thing. So there's this open historical question of whether or not the American revisions didn't leave us in the American version with a compromised document that actually contains contradictions. And some people, very prominent people like Kevin DeYoung, believe that is the case. We actually have a kind of inherent contradictions now in the American system. We'll get into it. All right, so you guys are noticing, I think, the big changes here. Let's just dive into this. First of all, we could talk about what they preserved, because of course, there is a bit here that's, for the most part, the same. And what's being agreed on, just by the way, in that portion that I underlined, what's being agreed on is that a position called Erastianism, have you guys ever heard of Erastianism? This was a movement that came out of Swiss Calvinist, Thomas Erastus was a Swiss Calvinist theologian who had a position that nobody really adopted as being correct, but one that for a moment during the Reformation had some sympathy. And Erastus's idea was the idea that the state is primarily actually a spiritual institution, and that in fact churches should not carry out church discipline, the state should. So churches could bring recommendations to the state that church discipline ought to be carried out, But the state was ultimately in charge of excommunicating people, of administering even the sacraments. It would have been understood that that was underneath the behest of the state. If you think of it as a hierarchy, the state is over the church in all of its things. The confession is really trying to accurately state that these are two independent side-by-side spheres, one over the physical, temporal, political realm, and the other over the spiritual realm. The church is over the spiritual realm. The souls and consciences of men is what's in view there. So they agree on that. But you still get, at least according to the minds of the Americans, many kind of lingering Erastian ideas that are in the original. And so while they leave that original statement, they remove a bunch of things. They remove, for instance, any language suggesting an established national church. So the word establishment isn't used in the original, but it's in view. Do you guys know what an establishment is? An established church? That would be the idea of a national church. There's soft establishment presently in Ireland, in, you know, actually the UK still has the Anglican Church. The Queen is the head of the church in the UK. So you have still vestiges of this. But back in those days, you would have had a lot stronger, what you might call hard establishment, especially in those old world churches, where if you were an independent church, you often couldn't operate. So you remember how John Bunyan, for instance, spent 12 and a half years in prison. He spent 12 and a half years in prison because he wasn't, he didn't have a license to preach in the state authorized church, as one of the reasons that he ran afoul of the law. And so that idea of, I think the language that they remove of the magistrate maintaining the unity and peace of the church is directly going after that idea of establishment. When you think of what it would look like for a magistrate to maintain the unity of the church, it sort of logically entails you'd need to have a national church that either you're a part of and you have to be a part of it, or, you know, there's no other option. They remove the language that blasphemies and heresies be suppressed. We'll talk a little bit about that at the end of our time here. They remove the language of the magistrate keeping the truth of God pure and entire, and reforming corruptions and abuses in worship and discipline. So the idea that the magistrate could correct a church on its discipline even, or correct a church on its worship, these are the sorts of things that get out of them. They also remove this idea that the magistrate has a right to call synods. Now, this is, of course, not only the Westminster Assembly in view, but a historic practice that goes back to the time of Constantine, right? Constantine called the synod or the Council of Nicaea. And so that's where the idea came from in its original form as it's expressed here. And the American revision said no more. We don't think that it's the duty or even power of the magistrate to call synods and be present at them. Here's what they added, number of things. They added, first of all, that phrase, as nursing fathers. Remember, that's a phrase that we learned from Isaiah 49 that loomed large in all of Protestant thinking on the subject of the magistrate, that the magistrate, in some sense, was a kind of covering of protection, the way a father is in his family, a covering of protection to the life of the church. And that is exactly what they go on to say. As nursing fathers, it is the duty of the civil magistrates to protect the church of our common Lord. So in some sense, defender. If we were being molested and, you know, there were people, well, this happened not too long ago, right? A protest broke out in a church in Minneapolis. We would understand that as a part of our confession, that it's the duty of the local magistrates to prevent that from happening, that we have a right to worship and should be protected in it. And the law of our land reflects that, actually, and we should be thankful for that. They added statements of toleration, so you have all denominations of Christians must be tolerated, and that all ecclesiastical persons shall enjoy the full, free, and unquestioned liberty. And then they add a statement here that there could not be violence against other persons on the basis of religion. So religious violence is condemned here. But it's interesting, there's an ongoing debate right now, because these are all hotly contested things in certain world corners of the internet. The PCA's going through big debates. They have a committee devoted to studying these matters. Whether or not what's being described here is the fact that there can never be any kind of legislative action on the part of the state against someone on the basis of religion. But I would just point out that that's not actually what this section says. So when it says the duty of civil magistrates is to protect the person and good name of all their people in such an effectual manner as that no person be suffered, either upon pretense of religion or infidelity, to offer any indignity, violence, abuse, or injury to any other person whatsoever. Notice what's in view there. It's me as a person taking in my own hands the law and saying, I'm going to commit violence against you because of the difference of our belief. No person is to be suffered to be allowed to do that. I can't do that in my private capacity as an individual. What it leaves open, though, is the question of whether the government is allowed to. So for instance, if the government were to say that witchcraft is made illegal, I hope we'd all agree that would be good. It would be nice if we didn't have occult palm readers, you know, on every corner, that sort of thing. That I don't think would be the same thing as a person suffering violence. Like, an orderly imposition of law is not abuse, indignity, violence. That's not what's in view. I think that would be important to recall. And then, you know, there's a variety of things that they didn't touch. So, for instance, they didn't touch the fact in 23.2 that the duty of the magistrate is to maintain piety. They didn't touch Larger Catechism 108. I know you don't, actually you do have it on the backside of your handout. Notice what Catechism 108, again on the Second Commandment, requires. So remember, they amended 109 and said you can't, you know, tolerating false religion is removed. But 108, the Second Commandment requires the disapproving, detesting, opposing all false worship, and according to each one's place and calling, removing it, and all monuments of idolatry. So according to one's place and calling, what's being described there is someone who is in a position of authority, governmental authority. That's what place and calling entails. If you were in that position, it is your duty to remove it. And this is true. You would recognize this to be true at every level of authority being exercised, right? So in your home, as fathers, you have a duty, according to your station and place, to not tolerate false religion. And that duty extends up to others in authority. I'd also note that actually Larger Catechism question 118 contains still, in our own version, a charge that the Sabbath needs to be kept especially by those who are in positions of authority. That word superiors here includes every kind of authority, including civil magistrates. So why is the charge of keeping the Sabbath more specially directed to governors of families and other superiors? The charge of keeping the Sabbath is more specially directed to governors of families and other superiors because they are bound not only to keep it themselves, but to see that it be observed by all that are under their charge, and because they are prone oft times to hinder them by employments of their own. It's really critical to note that the American revisers saw that as ongoing duty of the civil government to uphold the Sabbath. And this is immediately evident. So in 1810, the government passes a new statute that the U.S. Postal Service will deliver mail on Sunday. And from between the years of 1810 and 1820, the General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church petitions three times. They write petitions three times saying this is an abhorrence to the religion of this land, to common piety. This is the magistrate failing. And it's interesting to reflect on how actually that doesn't go away as a complaint. So when the Confederate states come into existence in 1863, the Southern Presbyterians, when they have their opportunity to basically leave their mark on that, is it Confederation? What was the document that they produced? I can't remember the title of it. But basically, they actually wrote it into the document of the Confederate states, the Constitution of the Confederate States. That mail would not be delivered on Sunday. This exact issue was a real big issue. So whatever they're removing as the duties of a magistrate, they're continuing and maintaining the duties of the civil magistrate to uphold the moral law. And interestingly, the first table of the moral law. So there's a whole debate. Some Christians say it's just the second table, all of those commandments that have to do with man treating man, that is the duty of a government to uphold. I just want to reflect that American Presbyterianism, at least through the 1860s, maintained vigorously the idea that the duty of the government was to uphold the moral law in totality, first and second table. What that looks like, of course, is hotly debated. So the question that's sort of raging today in various circles is, what do we do with these changes? How do these changes, for instance, relate to each other? So one of the great, well, here's a couple positions that I think totally overreach the evidence. They're just outlandish. Some would want to say that these changes mean that the American Revision and the presbyters that came up with it were interested in defending religious pluralism. So what they were really interested in is the current version of pluralism that we enjoy now. That basically our confession stands as a great blessing of this current situation. And I think that's obviously not in view for the American presbyters. It's not tenable. Modern applications of the First Amendment are not what our confession are underwriting. And I've got just a couple people noting this. Chad Van Dijkshoorn writes, "We should note that in introducing the words religion and religious in the edition, in addition to the previous reference to Christians and the church, American Presbyterians were unlikely to have been intentionally broadening their viewpoint to include protection and freedom for non-Christian religions. The major influx of cults and pagan religion did not reach any kind of prominence in America until the 19th century, especially towards its end." All right. So he's just saying that use of that word, it now means something much more neutral in our context if you are a religious person. If I say you're religious, I mean you just adopt any of the religions in the world. In that context, it meant very specifically that you are a Christian. That's what the use of that term meant contextually. Here's Kevin DeYoung. "I would argue that the principles of 1788 regarding the rights of conscience and liberty of worship should be extended to non-Christians in our day. But I grant that they did not conceive of the religious pluralism we now have in America." And in another context, DeYoung writes, "Virtually no one in America in the 19th century conceived of a political and social order devoid of religion. What's more, the religion which they assumed was necessary and ought to be protected and promoted was Protestant Christianity." And I would just say the evidence on this is overwhelming. Okay, so north, south, across every division that Presbyterianism in America has endured for 250 years, everyone has agreed on this in the 19th century at least. So, for instance, Charles Hodge, famous Princeton theologian, his son, Archibald Alexander, who we've heard from a bunch, I mean, they just argued extensively and wrote extensively in their systematic theology. So Hodge in his systematic theology says it's an indisputable fact that America is a Protestant Christian nation, and that is the religion of our people. Archibald Alexander says the same thing. Thornwall says the same thing. And in fact, everyone is saying this in the context in which they're slightly distressed that this is being forgotten. So, for instance, one of the major proposed amendments that American Protestants were interested in the 1800s was proposing an amendment to the Constitution in which the God of our fathers would be included. So both Charles Hodge, Archibald Alexander, were in support and actually lent their weight behind the idea that the Constitution needed an amendment to actually make explicit what they viewed as implied and commonly understood. It's one of the weaknesses of not speaking specifically that they observed. And it's interesting the way in which they even talk about this fact. Well, in advance of any kind of religious pluralism, Charles Hodge, for instance, says, you know, this is going to arise in the infidel, the Muslim, having just as much political standing in our nation as we do. And it's a problem because they don't. And yet, you see exactly how he saw the problem hundreds of years on. And you know, this is not only true of the Northern Presbyterians, like the Hodges, James Henry Thornwell in the South, when, again, the Confederate states are drafting their constitution, their articles of secession. This is a problem that he makes sure is fixed, that the God of our fathers is named, actually, in that. That it be an explicit acknowledgement of what everyone understood to be implicitly the case, which is that America was a Christian nation.